The Cultural Quarter is finally being recognised as one of the most innovative regeneration projects of its time. I recognise that historically there has been an inability to fully develop Stoke-on-Trent as a thriving destination with a vibrant competitive city centre or as a contemporary industrial success story. And while there is still much work to be done to change people's perceptions of our recently designated World Craft City, progressive championing of the Cultural Quarter as a key component in a post-centenary city centre linked to a strengthened citywide culture augurs well for all of the six towns. This also aligns with our aspirations to become a UNESCO creative city. As we celebrate the city's centenary by looking back, it's important we also recognise that heritage is arguably the strongest element of Stoke-on-Trent's current and future cultural offer as the next enticing chapter in our storied heritage unfolds. This is clearly evident when we look at how heritage anchors people to their roots, builds self-esteem, and enhances a sense of place, attachment, and cultural identity. In the city centre, plans are in place for the transformation of the Potteries Museum and Art Gallery to unlock the potential of culture, heritage, and creativity linked to the development of our city as an international centre for ceramics, on a par with other key global manufacturing centres. This will create pride in the wider region, attract visitors, investment and jobs, and make a difference to people's lives. Reform Heritage's appointment as one of 12 National Heritage Development Trusts and its commitment to the imaginative reuse of the city's many heritage assets is already paying dividends. With plans to breathe new life into Burslem's historical built environment, including the leopard, its custodianship of Bethesda Methodist Chapel will soon see the much-loved Cathedral of the Potteries become a thriving centre for education, offering exhibition, performance space and heritage interpretation events. Last month's unveiling of a statue to rock legend Lemmy in the Mother Town was described by sculptor Andy Edwards as a flag in the ground, with the focus now switched to turning the closed-down Queen's Theatre into a new music venue and art centre. Consultations are already underway on public realm proposals to improve business confidence and civic pride in Tunstall's historic town centre. Rhys Stokes' restoration of the ballroom at Fenton Town Hall as an exciting community arts venue has received national acclaim. And the quirky carnival and pig walk parade created by Urban Wilderness is just one part of the Longton regeneration story that celebrates community culture and creativity. Promoted as the biggest symbol of a Potteries Renaissance, the successful completion of the £60 million goods yard, a flagship urban project next to Stoke-on-Trent's train station and on the doorstep of Staffordshire University, was instrumental in capital and centric getting the green light from the City Council for what is potentially the most significant game-changing regeneration initiative to lead the city into its second century. Honouring the legacy of Josiah Spode's first Industrial Revolution pottery factory and building on the laudable work to establish a Cree tech community and cultural hub, Capital and Centric's plans will see the repurposed 10-acre Spode work site reimagined as a landmark destination. As stormtroopers of regeneration, it seems the next generation of artists, digital designers, creators, animators, sculptors and ceramicists are all set to bring new hope to a city looking to reclaim its national importance as an engine of creativity and growth.
So well done for getting through that. There's quite a long story there, but very interesting. And it was nice to hear about the garden festival and all those sorts of things. Okay, so my next story now in batch number one is Pride leaders demand Reform UK apology as Staffordshire funding row breaks out. Pride organisers are demanding an apology from a new Reform UK council leader. Stafford Pride is preparing to stage its second annual parade in August with a Bagger Chips headlining, who's a drag queen if you don't know, and the 2024 event costs more than £35,000, with the organisers receiving £1,700 from Staffordshire County Council or councillors and no charge to shut the parade road. It comes as new council leader Ian Cooper has told TV viewers that the local authority will not be funding the Pride event. He said, "We're not against Pride. Have a great time. Enjoy yourself. However, we're not going to spend taxpayers' money funding that. If you want to do that, go to the private sector, ask charities, put your hand in your own pocket. We think priorities are better spent on other things." Now, Stafford Pride Chairman Jack Taylor Walker wants an apology. He said that Councillor Cooper has stated that while he supports Stafford Pride, he does not believe that taxpayers' money should be paying for it. Yet, it doesn't. In 2024, four county councillors used part of their community fund to support the 2024 event to the total of £1,700, as the event matched and fitted criteria as set out under the council's community fund. And with the event costing well over £35,000 to hold, the donation was appreciated but went far from the total of hosting the event. In further support, AMEI, as a private company, arranged for our road closure for our parade as a donation to the event, and Staffordshire County Council, as a local authority, did not pay nor fund Stafford Pride apart from the aforementioned. Stafford Pride stands by each and every member of the LGBTQ plus community and is self-funded by local businesses, ticket sales and local small grants, including support from Staffordshire Borough Council with services in kind and with all proceeds funding the next year's event. We wait an apology from Councillor Cooper and his amendment on record in due course. So over to Liz, who's going to do her second article on the centenary in batch number one.
1925 and all that. As Stoke-on-Trent is celebrating 100 years as a city, historian Mervyn Edwards takes a look at other landmark events from the same year. In June 1925, a notice was placed in the Sentinel encouraging people to subscribe to a £2,000 appeal fund that would enable Stoke-on-Trent Council to complete the purchase of the new children's convalescent and holiday home at Rhyl. This had opened a month earlier, and the notice declared that this was a fine opportunity to show appreciation of the elevation of the county borough to a city by His Majesty King George V. Stoke-on-Trent's newly conferred city status was the talk of the six towns in 1925. But what else was happening in the Potteries in that year? Well, it is worth expanding upon that heartwarming children's convalescent home story. It opened with a civic outing involving nearly 300 people who travelled to North Wales courtesy of North Staffordshire's bus companies. Travel costs were waived and the buses departed from Stoke-on-Trent on Sundays, no doubt teeming with joyous young people. It was a groundbreaking idea that offered the children of indigent Potteries families the chance of a sunshine break. The kiddies stayed in a converted three-storey seafront building with extensive grounds and with tents for overspill accommodation. Gloriously, there were dunes and golden beaches nearby, so the children would have been as happy as sandboys. After the first 3 years of operation, it was reported that nearly 2,500 poor children had stayed in the home. Poverty in the Potteries was not unknown at this time, following a trade depression after the First World War, but for those who worked in the mining industry, propping up the local economy could still be a hazardous affair. On the 18th of December 1925, Birchenwood Colliery saw seven men killed in a pit explosion. Mind you, there had been good news for North Staffordshire miners in July, as Horton Lodge at Rudyard, the former home of Mr. Tellwright of the Sneed Collieries at Burslem, was opened as a rest home for colliery workers recovering from illness or injury. Those pitmen staying there enjoyed boating and fishing rights on the lake adjoining. Edward Brownfield Wayne, who was the managing director at Chatterley Whitfield Colliery, was influential in miners' welfare schemes in the 1920s and was on the joint management committee of the scheme that set up the miners' convalescent home at Rudyard. He died in April 1925. Fingers were pointed at another industrial behemoth of the area, the Shelton Iron, Steel and Coal Company's works at Etruria. Many local residents complained of that horrid noise that emanated from the firing of its boilers. A number of handsome buildings first saw the light of day in the 1920s, with the foundation stone of Tunstall's new Roman Catholic Church being laid in Queen's Avenue in May 1925. It would be called the Sacred Heart Church. There was considerable interest in this, with 3,000 people taking part in a ceremonial procession. The foundation stone of Burslem's new St. Joseph's Catholic Church in Hall Street was laid in September. The cinema world was gradually changing for the better and providing superior auditoria with slightly fewer fleas for lovers of the silver screen. Beginning life in 1892 as the Royal Alexandra Music Hall and later becoming the King's Palace Theatre, one Hanley venue moved with the times and became the Capitol in July 1925. It could boast of a super orchestra, cafe and lounge. Pretty plush, I think you'll agree, although the talkies wouldn't come to the Potteries until 1929. Well remembered by senior citizens today, this Goodson Street picture house closed in 1963. In the world of literature, two very accomplished writers were born in 1925. Arthur Berry in Small Thorn on the 7th of February and John Wayne in Penkull on the 14th of March. If we are to mention a very different type of culture, 1925 was the year when Stoke FC applied to the Staffordshire Football Association to change the name of the club to Stoke City Football Club, upon Stoke-on-Trent becoming numbered as one of the cities of the country. To many people this seemed like a good idea, but there was opposition from some quarters, with one Sentinel letter writer haranguing, "I would like to point out that the Stoke City FC is not the only football club in the city, neither was it by any means the premier club during last season." The suggestion was passed on by the writer 2 months ago to the chairman of the Port Vale Football Club that this club should change its name to Stoke City FC in the event of the county borough becoming a city. Another point in favour of Port Vale adopting the name of Stoke City is that its ground is in the heart of the city, Hanley at the time, and not on one side, as is the case of the Stoke ground. So here was a Port Vale fan who wished his club to be known as Stoke City. The name change of the Stoke club brought it no luck, as the newly named outfit finished second bottom of Division 2 in the 1925-26 season and was relegated to the Third Division North. Oh dear, how times have not changed. Well, Stoke did survive this year. The Burslem Association for the Prosecution of Felons met in December and, according to custom, offered its own review of the past year. The function was held in the Leopard in Marketplace, then undergoing extensive alterations. Today's motorists frequently grumble about potholes, but 'twas ever thus. The gathering in Burslem heard that it was no good complaining about the state of the roads because they were being constantly attended to. Like the mining trade, the pottery industry was struggling. It was noted, and had done so all year. Meanwhile, for a peek at what was generally weighing on the minds of pottery's folk in 1925, you can do far worse than pore over the long-running Sentinel feature, Crocs and Crazes, Local Sayings and Doings, and of course the newspaper's ever-vibrant letters columns. Never mind today's so-called expenses-seeking overpaid councillors. The Sentinel made a point of standing up for the mayor, whose motor car bill for the year was about £250, which was having to be paid by the postholder. This newspaper declared that mayoral expenses never covered the financial demands of the job, and that a mayor of modest means was effectively being financially penalised for undertaking all the engagements he had to attend across the city. The council must look into this matter again, declared the Sentinel of Stoke-on-Trent's cheese pairing council. Lastly, what did the editors of Crocs and Crazes, a laid-back and whimsical read that often captured the city vibe, have to say about the King's momentous conferring of city status on Stoke-on-Trent? Was united strength really stronger, or were local rivalries still dying hard in 1925? Well, in some Stoke-on-Trent Council notices, Stoke Town Hall was beginning to be referred to, without authority, as the City Hall. This ruffled the feathers of folk in the other five towns. Observer, author of the Crocs and Crazes column, added, I am told, by the way, that there are residents in Stoke who suppose that it was the old town of Stoke that was created a city, and not the county borough as a whole. In the light of the recent debate about Newcastle's potential takeover by Stoke-on-Trent, I'd like to apprise readers of a bit of banter dating back to July 1925 at the time of the Hanley Flowers Show luncheon. The Mayor of Newcastle offered his congratulations to the Mayor of Stoke on the granting of city status. Alderman Sampson Walker responded, congratulating the Newcastle Mayor on Newcastle's continued independence, he hoped that that independence would continue for many years. Unless, added Walker, with a devilish twinkle in his eye, it became part of the city of Stoke-on-Trent. So in 1925, there was still talk of Newcastle being joined with Stoke and still opposition to it. And I will not say what I think of all that.